Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
Hello, and welcome to episode 45 of the Brewbound podcast, presented by BevNet, where we bring you interviews with some of the most well-known figures throughout the beer industry. Today is Thursday, July 18th. My name is Chris Frenari, and I am on a boat in the Bahamas. Not really. I'm recording way ahead of time, but I am on a boat in the Bahamas on July 18th. But Justin Kendall's here with us.
Yeah, I'm still here.
He is still alive and kicking.
I'm still at work.
As for me, future me, I might be stuck in a hurricane. Who knows? We have no idea what's going to happen.
Man, all the possibilities.
That's actually a good place to start our banter here. Hurricane. It is hurricane season, and I'm going fishing in the area where hurricanes are. So for the first time in my life, the first time ever, I bought travel insurance on my flight.
You're so brave.
Have you ever done that?
No, never.
It's kind of like playing blackjack, where you're never supposed to buy insurance at when you're playing blackjack. That's what they tell you. But in this case, I think my ticket, it was last minute trip. My ticket was like $700 or something around. It was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance was like $40. And I was like, you know what? Hurricane season. If something happens, $40, like I'll throw away $40 for that protection.
You might as well.
Yeah.
There's no reason not to for $40 on that type of ticket.
I feel like there are rare instances where the travel insurance actually makes sense, and this is it.
So you're not going to be on a boat next week after all.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I will find out on Tuesday morning at like 5 a.m.
What's the forecast?
It's looking okay. There is, like, we have a hurricane watch app that my friend's dad keeps sending us screenshots from, and there is a hurricane formation or storm formation or something forming out in the ocean that could eventually head toward where we're at, but it's very far away.
Try not to get lost at sea.
I will try not to. I'm not bringing any podcast equipment with me, so I can't record my final thoughts and my final words if we do. I'll do a cell phone, and if the boat gets recovered, I'll make sure that it's in a waterproof area of the boat.
The black box.
The black box, yeah. Yes. I'll put it in the black box. So, yes, I'm leaving. I'll be back, though, and that's why we're recording early, and that's why this episode is a little bit short, and we don't have too much to talk about, but...
Yeah, there's nothing going on in the beer industry.
No, there really isn't. We're not going to have any news to report, no headlines. Nobody's doing anything. But actually, before we do headlines, seltzer. Can we talk seltzer for a minute?
Is there a podcast when we don't talk about seltzer?
These days? Not so. Okay, so seltzer is... There are a number of things over the last week that kind of hit about seltzer. There was the Trevor Wallace character,
mm-hmm.
like the
comedian
viral meme guy or viral video guy.
Ain't no laws when you're drinking claws.
And I think we brought him up or we mentioned it like in a previous podcast. But he made this videos like dudes who drink White Claw once. And it was like, you know, all the things that people do when they all the, you know, stereotypical bros like, oh, you're still drinking IPAs? Like, why aren't you drinking White Claws? And he came up with the tagline, ain't no laws when you're drinking claws. And he sold 7,000 T-shirts with a sort of parodied design of the White Claw logo. He mimicked the trade dress. And
Lee Corso would say, not so fast, my friend.
Yes. And as it turns out, you can't really do that. Who would have known?
He thought he tweaked the logo, though.
No, he was riding the wave real hard, and the wave came crashing down on him. And my favorite was, he said, apparently there are laws when you mess with the claws.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Mark Anthony Brands or their legal team or some combination thereof, they taffered it. They shut it down. So he had to refund like 7,000 people that had bought shirts, which kind of sucks. I mean, I feel like they shouldn't. I get it. They got to protect their trademark and they got to protect their image. But this, like, you couldn't ask for anything more amazing to happen to one of your brands.
They should have linked up somehow.
They should have just said, like, dude, make the shirts one time. We'll let you profit off it one time. We'll even, like, help you design it or something.
Are the shirts, were they actually made?
I don't think so, because he wasn't wearing any, like, when he was pitching and promoting it in these videos. And I think it was one of those things where it's like he had the design. He was going to see how many orders he got, and he did a real short buying window, and then he was going to go get them printed.
Mm.
So I don't think they were ever actually created.
I was going to say there's probably going to be some black market shirts out there somewhere.
Well, but now that it's, like, the design is out there, couldn't somebody just, like, kind of go make it low-key and just run off a few shirts?
Absolutely.
And I feel like I've seen bootleg. We talked about this, like, months ago. I saw people at the Boston Marathon with, like, bootleg White Claw shirts.
Just set up on the Santa Monica Pier or somewhere and start selling them.
But here's the thing. Like, shouldn't they just embrace it? Shouldn't companies embrace? Like, this is new media right now. Like, we're real-time, like, watching how things go from just a concept, just a product that you launch, to a viral sensation.
One, it would seem to be good press for them to embrace it.
Yeah.
Rather than just be like, hey, guy nobody's heard of, but now has sort of hit on something, we're going to shut you completely down.
Yeah, I feel like if you're in the marketing department at Mark Anthony, like, reach out to this guy, embrace it, and, like, I'd put him in an Instagram ad or something. Like, use this to your advantage.
Exactly.
I think it's a huge oversight. So that was one hard seltzer thing that happened. Then
Truly.
So Truly slid in.
Yeah.
Truly was like, they tried to come up with their own tagline, like, getting unruly with Truly. Or no, was that
no,
the one
that was
I
yours.
Came? That was mine. Okay. So they should have done unruly with Truly.
Yeah.
No rulies when you're drinking Trulies is what they did.
Yeah.
I'm giving that like a 5 out of 10 on the old Richter scale of my excitement.
I'll give it a 6, but it ain't no, you know.
It ain't no laws when you're drinking the claws.
Yeah.
So that happened. We'll see if maybe Truly is able to sneak in and do something there. But kudos to at least, you know, trying. Like, they're trying.
Yeah.
They're doing what Mark Anthony should have done.
Absolutely.
So that's that. Also, I got pinged by a Salon.com writer, and she was asking about White Claw being the drink of summer. And so I think there's a Salon.com article right now up on Salon.com that's called It's a White Claw Summer, Like It or Not. Very well written piece, not only because I'm quoted in it, but but apparently, this is another one that I liked. Apparently, there is a phrase down in Austin, Texas, when a bar runs out of White Claws, they call it getting declawed. They've been declawed.
That's pretty good.
I like that too.
Yeah.
So this is the thing. Like, there are so many opportunities for White Claw to leverage these fun ways that consumers are interacting with the brand. And I say they should just embrace it.
They should totally embrace it.
Go all in on this.
So while you're hot now doesn't mean you're going to be hot, you know, 2 years from now or whatever.
Exactly. I mean, this could be like hard soda and just, you know, be gone next summer.
Yeah.
So you really got to capitalize when you have the opportunity. Speaking of Austin, Texas, there's a new seltzer brand that launched in Austin, Texas this past week called Shotgun Seltzer, which I believe is named for like calling shotgun in the front seat of a car.
Yeah. Well, their tagline's call it, right?
Yeah. Unless you like you shoot clay pigeons with a shotgun, do you call
it?
I don't think so.
Is it calling it? Well, yeah, I guess it is calling it for the car, but in the beverage industry, it's a totally different.
Yeah, you call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're doing an on-draft strategy. So all on-premise, all on-draft is, they're not doing any packages. But here's the thing. So there's opportunity on-draft, right? But all of the White Claw and Truly and Smirnoff and, you know, next brand, it's all being sold off-premise.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this Salon.com article, it starts out with a story about a guy buying 11 cases of White Claw to take to the lake for a weekend at a liquor store.
People want those slim cans.
So I get it. You want to go after the draft accounts, but everyone's buying this stuff like for lakes and boating and for all the off-premise, you know, opportunities that
How much are you taking on your boat?
I don't think they, well, if they sell White Claw down in the Bahamas, I'll definitely buy some, but it's more of a spirits adventure down there. It's rum and vodka, as we do Bloody Marys, because beers are like $2 a beer in the Bahamas. It's not great value, but we'll have some like Corona Lights and stuff, or some Caliques maybe, or some Sands. There's like basically two beers in the Bahamas, Sands and Calique. They're both disgusting. And you need a lot of lime to get through them. Lastly, on the shotgun piece, I get it. I get the on-premise strategy. There's some opportunity there. But there are so many brands coming out now, and they said that they were changing the landscape of the hard seltzer category. A brand that's never sold a drop of liquid is suddenly changing the landscape. And I asked a friend of a friend of the owner, or a friend of the owner, and on Twitter, I said, well, how are they changing the landscape? And actually, Shotgun Seltzer replied and said, local, craft, and draft. And I'm just like thinking, like, that's not enough to differentiate yourselves these days. Local, craft, and draft. Like, 7,500 plus craft breweries out there. A lot of them making seltzer. Local, we get it. You're like, local, we've talked about this. It's not a differentiator anymore. And on draft, we just spent time talking about how it's like you don't see seltzer on draft, really.
Yeah. And
very limited.
Brizzo, Noda's seltzer in North Carolina, they're doing draft, aren't they?
Yeah. And Truly and White Claw are doing the pure on draft. Very limited opportunities on draft. So those three things right there have me a little bit concerned. If that's your strategy, if that's your whole differentiation, their wholesaler that they're launching with too.
Brown
Distributing sells White Claw, Bon and Viv, Austin East Ciders, Kyla Kombucha, Mighty Swell, which is like a spritzer cocktail. I mean, they're selling a lot of beverages that's already attacking that consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you fit?
They've got, what, two or three of the top five?
Yeah.
What's going to take priority?
Where do you fit? How do you get mind share in that book?
That's a tough book.
That's my question. And these, look, for our listeners, these are the things you need to think about, right? Like, you got to think about your strategy. You got to have a solid brand proposition and differentiators before you launch. You got to know this stuff, and you got to be buttoned up. Now, that being said, the team over at Shotgun has some experience.
They worked at Cellus, right?
Yeah, they've had some experience at Cellus, but also before that at Miller Coors. I think one of the co-founders or the CEO spent some time at Brown Distributing as an on-premise director. So I get it. There's a lot of experience there, and the blocking and tackling they probably understand quite well, but the brand and that stuff probably needs a little bit of polishing up. And I think everybody in the beer space needs some polishing up on the brand and the marketing and understanding that, which is the perfect segue for headlines here.
Well, are we going to change the landscape of headlines?
I think we are going to change the landscape of headlines. Speaking of marketing, Lagunitas, based in Northern California, has named former Vans Vice President Kelly Murnigan as its new chief marketing officer. The craft brewery, which is owned by Heineken, grew 6% and brewed more than 1 million barrels of beer in 2018, but off-premise sales are roughly flat midway through this year.
The great-grandson of Anheuser-Busch co-founder Adolphus Busch is shutting down his 8-year-old Craftig lager brand after sales fell nearly 42% over the last 2 years. According to founder William Billy Busch, his plans to sell a high-quality beer at an affordable price ultimately proved unsuccessful.
Salt Lake City, Utah's Uinta Brewing confirmed that the Riverside Company, a private equity firm that had acquired a stake in the brewery business back in 2014, has exited its investment. Golub Capital, which helped finance the 2014 transaction, stepped up to buy out Riverside and now holds a controlling stake in the business.
Lastly, the Brewers Association has severed ties with longtime PR firm The Rosen Group. After more than a decade, the Boulder-based not-for-profit trade group has chosen another Colorado entity, Backbone Media, as its new agency of record. Backbone will be tasked with providing media relations and strategic communications support for the BA's member and consumer-facing initiatives and priorities. And those are your headlines.
All right, let's get to our interview with Beer Institute CEO Jim McGreevy. We caught up with Jim during the BI's annual meeting last month to get the latest on the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act and to chat about how the Washington, D.C.-based trade group works on behalf of the entire beer industry to push for policy change. During our conversation, we also asked Jim what it's like to work in D.C. at a time when things are so uncertain and when President Donald Trump changes his mind on important issues literally every single day. All right, here he is, Jim McGreevy. Chris Frenari here with my colleague Justin Kendall, and today we're in St. Louis at the Beer Institute annual meeting, and we've got Jim McGreevy, the CEO of the Beer Institute, joining us on the podcast today. Jim, welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Justin.
For our listeners that maybe are a little bit more familiar with the Brewers Association, help them understand, you know, who the Beer Institute is, how it differs from the BA, and what you guys do. Because I think a lot of our craft brewery listeners probably see the Brewers Association more than they see the Beer Institute.
Right, right. Well, the first thing I'll tell them is that the Beer Institute is one of the oldest trade associations in Washington, D.C. We've been around since 1862. We were founded as the U.S. Brewers Association back in 1862 because the brewers of the time, who were mostly immigrants and first-generation Americans, wanted to support the country in a time of crisis, and that crisis was the Civil War. And the first federal beer excise tax was put in place to help fund the Civil War. And the brewers of the time, as I said, wanted to help the union in a time of crisis. They created the trade association to help in, quote, the orderly collection of the tax. And that's a quote from our origination documents that were written in both German and English, to help in the orderly collection of the tax. And that tax obviously has been around to this very day. It's only been reformed about four times in a comprehensive way over those 160 plus years. And one of those times was in 2017, which is how the Craft Beverage Modernization Act plays into this conversation. But the Beer Institute's been around a long time. We are probably seen as the trade association for the large brewers. Our largest members are Anheuser-Busch, MillerCoors, Heineken USA, and Constellation. But we have plenty of craft brewers. We have plenty of suppliers to the industry. We do our work in Washington, D.C. I say we only do federal policy, but we do it very well. And we have a group of 11 professionals who work in communications and advocacy and legal issues and regulatory issues. So I'm proud to say that we fight above our weight in terms of beer trade associations and other trade associations. And I've been there 5 years and enjoying every minute of it.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth, 2143, at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today, and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
So dispel the rumor that you guys are only for large beer companies. You do have small beer companies that are members, including folks like Rogue and Cape May and
Two Roads.
Two Roads and Sprecher. Our friend Franklin Dismuke from Eagle Creek. Yeah. So, you know, there are plenty of small brewers that are members. Why should a small brewery consider being a Beer Institute member as well?
Well, I think they should consider being a Beer Institute member because we're helping them on some of the most critical things that are happening in their business. I'm really proud of the work we've done on the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act. When I got to the Beer Institute 5 years ago, the small brewers and the big brewers were fighting over what tax relief should look like. And that battle had been raging for about 8 years. And in some ways, that battle wasn't helping anybody in Washington, D.C. It wasn't helping beer with policymakers. It wasn't just me that saw that. It was lots of other people. And there was some work done and some dialogue created that created an opportunity for all brewers to benefit from tax relief. That turned into the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act. And we passed that bill less than 2 years after it was introduced, after multiple years of fighting about the issue. So I think that we bring a certain amount of maturity to the discussion around advocacy. Not to say that others don't, but I'm really proud of the work that our team does in terms of thinking about the policy issues, particularly in Washington, D.C., and then finding some ways to get results. So if any of your listeners are putting their beer in aluminum cans or in aluminum bottles, they're facing the tariff, the aluminum tariff issue. And I think we've done a very good job as an organization speaking for beer on that topic in particular. So like I said, we only do federal policy, but we do it well. And I think there's room for us to grow to include more brewers in our roster of members.
Absolutely.
You mentioned the excise tax reform, which sunsets at the end of this year. So there's really been no time for you guys to sort of rest on the victory that was the Craft Beverage Modernization Act. Now you've got majority support in both houses.
The House and the Senate.
Yeah, the House and the Senate. Tell us a little bit about the effort that's ongoing and how you see it unfolding throughout this year.
Well, I think you're right, Justin. We didn't really have a chance to enjoy the victory that much because when President Trump signed the bill into law, or signed the bigger bill into law that included our tax relief provisions, that was December of 2017, a couple days before Christmas. And then we immediately moved into the implementation phase with the TTB and the CPB. For those importers bringing their beer in from other parts of the world. And that took up several months just sort of getting the regulators who needed to come up with regulations to get those regulations in place. So we've seen one full year implementation of the tax relief provisions in 2018. We're in the middle of the relief in 2019. And since it's only a two-year bill, we have to go back and get another 2 years, or more importantly, make it permanent. So that's the work that's happening there. And I think that's the important piece when you're thinking about trade association politics and beer. That's the important piece to note, that the Brewers Association and the Beer Institute are working very closely on this. We each have our own strengths to bring to the table to convince a wide group of legislators that they should be for it, and to convince the administration that they should sign it. So now the issue really is looking for the bigger tax vehicle, similar to the one that we were put in 2017, that will get that extension. We expect that there will be some kind of tax legislation before the end of the year. But in the legislative process, one has to learn to live with ambiguity. So as of today, June 11, 2019, we don't know where that vehicle is going to be. We expect it in the fall. We expect it before Christmas. But we don't know what it's going to be. So we have to make sure that we have enough co-sponsors on the bill, that this thing is locked down as a consensus choice of the super majority of legislators. And we're definitely there in the Senate. We're almost there in the House. We had more than 300 co-sponsors on the bill in the House last Congress. As of today, I think we have 226. So we're marching towards 300. We're well over what we had last Congress in the Senate. And I think we can probably knock on the door of 70 senators. There's only 100 of them. So I think we're doing good work on phase one as we are watching to see how phase two develops. And then you put it all together and you keep it going.
What's it like operating with that kind of uncertainty? Because we're talking about $130 million in savings for the beer industry as a result of the reform that was put in place at the end of 2017 or beginning of 2018. And I mean, it cuts the excise tax on the first 60,000 barrels of beer for small brewers from 7 to 350, lowers it from 18 to 16 on barrels up to 6 million barrels. So I mean, there's a lot at stake here. And, you know, if we go back to 2017 excise pricing, we got a lot of breweries, 7,000 plus breweries that are going to be impacted. So what's it like operating with that kind of uncertainty?
Well, I'm certainly not minimizing the seriousness of this for any one brewer who depends on that tax relief. But I do think in the legislative process, you do have to live with a certain amount of ambiguity. I mean, you've got a divided Congress between Democrats and Republicans. You've got, a president who is unlike any other, certainly. We as advocates, I think you learn to manage the ambiguity of the process by having a plan and executing on the plan and having allies amongst, allies like the Brewers Association and others who are rowing in the boat in the same direction as you are, and then having important champions. And we have important champions up and down the legislative process. So we're very focused on the House Ways and Means Committee. We're very focused on the Senate Finance Committee. We're very focused on making sure that the leadership of the of both houses of Congress understand the importance of the bill to brewers of all sizes. So I think if you have a plan and you work the plan, you know, what's that old saying? Plan your work and work your plan. You can minimize the uncertainty, but there is plenty of uncertainty. That's why we really need to make the bill permanent. That's the real super goal of this whole effort.
At the same time that you're fighting for permanence on that, you're also dealing with a whole other issue of tariffs and the uncertainty there. And we've just seen in recent weeks and months that aluminum and steel tariffs have come off in Canada and Mexico. Tell us how you sort of juggle those two issues, how you work those together.
Well, I mean, I think we have a good basis for support in Congress on the craft beverage bill. We're seeing that. We introduced the bill 4 months ago, and we're talking now about these giant majorities that we're building up in both the House and Senate. The tariff issue is a little different, obviously. It's more of an administrative issue. So the president of the United States, Donald Trump, came to Washington with, I would say, people would agree, very sort of few set views on any policy issue. The one set view he has espoused for the last 40 years is that America is getting taken to the cleaners when it comes to trade. So we knew this going in. We didn't know that the steel and aluminum tariffs were going to be a specific end result of his greater worldview about trade. And you sort of try to figure out how to manage the issue. It's very important for us to be able to go talk to the people who are making the decisions. And I think what I've found with this issue is, you know, your listeners may recall that the tariffs for aluminum were put in place in March of 2018. It's now June of 2019. So they've been in place for 15 or 16 months. At the beginning of our work on this issue, we were telling everybody with two ears about the impacts that this would have on beer. And I think there were plenty of people in the administration that didn't really believe us, didn't really want to focus in on our viewpoint at the time. They were moving forward with a plan that they had developed and was very important to them, one of their primary policy focuses of the beginning of the Trump administration. But now I think after 15 or 16 months, our arguments that we've been consistently giving them are having more salience. So the longer the tariffs go on, the more impact to brewers of all sizes. The fact that brewers are talking about this issue with members of Congress, there's another sort of piece of the echo chamber. Members of Congress are hearing from their constituents. And as we heard from several speakers today at our conference about the tariff issue, the president and his team are not immune to hearing the local impacts of things like the steel and aluminum tariffs. So I think you just have to sort of stick with it. There's a certain amount of stick-to-itiveness that you have to do in this kind of work to get where you want to be at the end of the day. Is it impactful for your members or others while you're doing it? Yes, it is. There are costs to this. That's why it's important for us to be able, as advocates, to give the arguments and, like in the craft beverage issue, bring other supporters to the table. So it's kind of a marathon around the steel and aluminum tariffs. But I'm beginning to see that we are starting to make some headway in terms of policymakers at the highest levels hearing our arguments. And that's when, if they're hearing your arguments, they're going to start to think about ways that they can help you fix the problem you have.
So two kind of follow-up questions on the tariff issue. The first is, we talked about, you know, kind of operating with uncertainty. How do you prepare your members for operating in an environment where, you know, one day they wake up, there's no tariffs, the next day it's quite possible that there could be tariffs?
You communicate a lot with the different members. You hear their points of view. You get consensus on whether you can move forward with a singular point of view to the people who are thinking about the decision or considering the policy. And then you marshal the facts. We were able to very quickly at the Beer Institute, I think the president tweeted this out on a Sunday night or a Monday night at 8:30. And I think by the next morning, we had a fairly good sense as a Beer Institute team what the impact would be, because we were able to, you know, get our chief economist crunching numbers and get our policy people talking to folks in the administration, talking to our members. So we had a pretty good sense very quickly of how much this would cost the industry. And this is true on every policy issue. Beer is an easy thing for people to understand the bigger policy issue. So reporters, policymakers, they can use beer as a way of telling the story of the bigger issue.
Right.
And we've seen that in the aluminum tariffs. We've seen that with the tax relief issue, the craft beverage bill. And I thought we saw it with the Mexican tariffs. Now, there are other bigger political issues and considerations that you're going to have a hard time getting around no matter how good your arguments are. So you marshal the arguments, you understand the landscape, and you figure out where the thing is going. No, I don't think there are any issues that have moved so quickly in Washington, D.C. as these kinds of proposals that President Trump has done over the last 2 years. Congress moves slow. The federal policy apparatus moves slow. President Trump has made that go faster, number one, and he's used tariffs as a blunt instrument to effectuate behavior change in other people.
Yeah.
And he just got to learn to deal with that. But I do think that given our experience with the aluminum tariffs, we were able to figure out how to proceed as a trade association on the Mexican import tariff. He's going to bring it back again? Yep, he's going to bring it back again. You just got to be ready for round two, I guess. In the aluminum tariff example, he basically announced that the aluminum tariffs were going to go into effect at a meeting where the reporters came in and he just announced it. So this is the way of Washington, at least for now, either for the next 2 years or the next 6 years.
He does his work 140 characters at a time, or I guess 240 characters now.
So I think the interesting thing will be whether the way he has changed Washington is a permanent thing or just the change while he's in office. I think that will be very interesting to see how he's used Twitter. He's got 63 million followers on Twitter. Other politicians certainly use Twitter, but I don't think that there's ever been... President Trump is the most successful user of Twitter, obviously, if you count that by the number of followers and the way he uses it to impact policy. Now he's president of the United States, so he's got a big bully pulpit, right? Actually, it's interesting. I think the second biggest... the politician with the second biggest following on Twitter, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yep.
So, you know, is it President Trump that's changing the way politicians communicate to the broader public? Or is it him plus the change in technology and the adoption more and more of Twitter? I guess we'll see. But yeah, for us as advocates, we have to sort of figure out all of those pieces to come out with what we hope is the best outcome for the members in the industry.
And maybe you need some more Twitter followers.
We definitely need some more Twitter followers.
Now, my second question was going to be, and then we'll move on from tariffs, but we talk about the impact that tariffs have on the industry. And, you know, there was a headline story in Bloomberg a few weeks back that said the U.S. beer industry blames Trump tariffs for 40,000 job losses. And they were pulling stats out of the Beer Serves America report. And the narrative was these tariffs are hurting the industry and it's costing jobs. But the reality is that most of those jobs were lost before the tariffs were implemented. And, you know, we started seeing companies laying people off ahead of the implementation of these tariffs. So, you know, I'm sort of curious to understand what the quantifiable impact of tariffs has been, other than, say, Miller Coors saying it's going to cost us, you know, X, $40 million. You know, have we seen documented job loss as a result of tariffs? Have we seen companies say, I've lost X amount? I think Summit said they lost 130. Like, what is the
160,000?
What is the quantifiable impact of these tariffs?
Well, I think the added tax burden is a quantifiable impact of the tariffs. So, Summit estimates it's $160,000. Cape May estimates it's 30. Miller Coors estimates it's $40 million. You know, we don't write the headlines, unfortunately. So I think the headline writer sort of took some license there that we were not, that's not what we were saying when we were talking about the Beer Serves America report. I think you get the quantifiable numbers from the amount that brewers are finding that this costs them, because I've seen documents from aluminum brokers and brewers showing the price increase of aluminum. It's just going to happen. It's a tax. It's, so somebody's got to pay the tax. And I think you see it in other sort of soft ways. You see it in maybe brewers not hiring as many people. You see them maybe not innovating as faster. I've said this before. After the craft beverage bill was signed into law in December, I talked to brewers who are our members and not our members for the next 2 months. And they were talking about, first of all, they all knew exactly how much tax relief they were going to get. And they all had plans for that tax relief. But, you know, some of them very specific plans. And then 2 months later, there was a tax increase. So if you're a production brewery putting your beer in aluminum bottles or aluminum cans, you started to then have to make the choice about, well, I was going to do this with the extra money, but now maybe I can't do it. So I think, you know, there's headlines and then there's reality. And I think there's a lot of different ways to sort of cut the impact on brewers other than specific job loss. So we have definitely seen people not investing in their businesses in the way they thought they might after December of 2017. We've seen some job loss. You know, it's pretty well documented in some big cases of job loss just in the last 6 months or so. You can account some of that to the aluminum tariffs. You can account some of that to the individual business's own issues. But there's no doubt that the aluminum tariffs have raised the cost of production for brewers, and that's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
I know. Not to mention higher cost for beer.
Yeah.
Certainly some of these 7,000 or some of these brewers that are putting their beer in aluminum cans and aluminum bottles are raising the price.
Yeah, and right now I think the larger companies have decided not to, but it's quite possible that there are some smaller breweries that have and we just don't know.
Yeah, right.
Category health. So this has been an ongoing initiative that it's been on, it's been off, it's been on, it's been off. Where are we at on the category health initiative?
I said from the stage at the Beer Institute annual membership meeting this morning that the three trade associations were going to work together to launch a campaign this summer to promote and to grow beer. We've been having these discussions in various stages of development for really the last 3 or 4 years. And depending on the issues related to different companies or trade associations or the other work that trade associations and companies were doing, it's sort of gone up and down the list of priorities. But there's no doubt that spirits in particular is eating beer's lunch in many ways, and they've been doing it for years. And there's been a long discussion in beer, at least that I observed when I started at the Beer Institute 5 years ago. There was a lot of navel-gazing about the problem. And today, we were able to say in a clear voice that the three trade associations were going to work on finding solutions. There's a lot of details to work out in terms of what the campaign looks like, when it will be launched, although it will be launched very soon, who's paying for it, all of that stuff will sort of be worked out. But I do think this is sort of a seminal moment in beer. We're not afraid to fight with each other in beer, but we're also growing the muscle of working together more and more. And I think this is an example of that.
But the BI won't be contributing any funds to it.
No, we'll be working on the plan. We'll be working on the execution of the plan. But at this moment, we're not putting any money into it. But we'll be there with others who are going to fund it to make sure that it tells a story about why beer as a category should be promoted.
And I guess to that end, do we know what it looks like yet? Is it national advertising? Is it TV? Is it print? Is it digital? Is it?
We've been talking to ad agencies about specific plans for a campaign launch. I'm not going to talk about it here because it's still in development, but we have some very good ideas about ways to promote beer to a broad audience of consumers who we hope will buy more beer.
Well, I think that's definitely needed these days. We need more people drinking beer. Hard seltzer's flying off the shelf, but
Hard seltzer's flying off the shelf.
But we need people drinking beer.
But isn't that, I mean, I do think that that's not just a passing comment, right? More and more brewers, whether they're big or small, are doing other things beyond traditional beer. And I think hard seltzers are 250% up year to date.
Yeah, 193% according to Nielsen.
Of course, off a small base, right? But this is how beer promotes itself in different ways to different consumers than they did 30, 40, 100 years ago. This is how brewers build different kinds of business product lines through innovation. So if you take the innovation that brewers are doing at all levels, you take a promotional campaign of some kind run by their trade associations, you start to make headway.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's important.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the results of the campaign. We're praying that tariffs are not implemented, and we're also going to be looking out for permanent federal excise tax relief for brewers. In the meantime, if somebody wants to get in touch with you about joining the Beer Institute, one of our small brewery listeners, what's the best way to do that?
They can email me at jmcgreevy@beerinstitute.org. They can call me at 202-661-5376, or they can go on the website at beerinstitute.org.
Well, there you have it. Thanks so much for joining the pod, Jim.
Thanks, Chris. Jim. Thank you, Justin.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right, that was our interview with Beer Institute CEO Jim McGreevy. Always great to spend a little bit of time with Jim. They put on a wonderful Beer Institute meeting. I think we talked about it a few episodes back, and we had a great time in St. Louis at the Busch Stadium, throwing pitches and swinging the old lumber down there.
Well, swinging the lumber.
Batting cages.
Maybe not throwing pitches.
You didn't have such a great time throwing pitches, but we had a great time interviewing Jim during the meeting. And since we last spoke to Jim, there have been a few updates on kind of the progress of craft beverage and some of the other initiatives. So let's get you caught up on that before we share our takeaways.
Yeah, the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act has a few more supporters. In the House, they have 243 supporters. In the Senate, they have 66. So those numbers are going up by the day pretty much at this point.
So when you hear this, they might even be a little bit higher.
Probably, if you check their Instagram account.
And then there's also the APEX Act, which was introduced in the Senate. Now, Justin, what's the APEX Act?
That is on aluminum pricing and looking for more oversight from, I believe it's the FTC and the DOJ on that.
Okay. And does it have more support than, I'm hoping that it has more support than when it was first introduced.
A few more supporters in the House. They have 24, and in the Senate, they're up to two, one co-sponsor. So,
okay. So a long way to go in the Senate on that, but transparency in aluminum pricing is desperately, desperately needed in the beer industry for sure.
Yeah.
And we also are waiting on the fruits of the beer industry health initiative, beer category health initiative, and seeing the campaign that is supposedly being worked on behind the scenes. I guess let's start there, because one of my takeaways was that, you know, they've actually got all the trade groups working together, BI, BA, and NBWA, on a category health campaign. This was something that we've written about a few times over the last, I don't know, year and a half or so. It was on again, it was off again, as we said in the interview. And right now, because of this whole corn syrup debacle between AB and Miller Coors, you have some companies that have decided not to support it financially. I think Anheuser-Busch has committed to supporting it financially.
The Miller Coors is a no.
Miller Coors is a no.
HUSA is a no.
Heineken USA is a no. But the Beer Institute is going to throw some support behind it, not necessarily financial contributions, but they're adding support and resources. And the important part here is that all three trade groups are at least in active discussion on what this campaign should look like. They're talking to ad agencies. So I don't know, maybe it'll be a digital campaign, maybe it'll be billboards, maybe it'll be a commercial, but we should see something.
End of summer
at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think the campaign will look like, if you had to guess?
I keep throwing out the got milk or the, you know, what is it, beef, it's what's for dinner, those type of aspirational type of campaigns.
If you could help design the campaign, what would you highlight?
Man, that's a good question. I think you just got to show it in a number of occasions with people who are drinking it that you wouldn't expect.
Right. So you have to have diversity.
It's got to be diverse.
Yep.
You can't just be beardos like you and me.
Right. You got to have a wide range of styles. So, you know, stouts, ales, lagers. You got to have a variety of settings. I think highlighting the versatility of beer.
They were really pushing hard on beer and food pairings. So I would not be shocked to see that being a part of the campaign.
Yeah, beer and food would be a good thing to include. I think, you know, showing the sort of wide range of occasions where beer can play, whether it's at a sporting event or out at the beach or in a fine dining establishment, like you really got to highlight that it's not just like for sitting on your couch on a Sunday and watching football.
Yeah, right. It's got to be in those white tablecloth type environments.
Well, there you go. We've just designed the category health campaign for the beer industry. So now we just need some companies to go out there and buy that that airtime.
I'm sure these are things that they haven't thought of at all.
No, this is groundbreaking, revolutionary stuff. The other takeaways that I kind of had jotted down here was just the importance of communicating with members on important policy issues. So things are moving so quickly in Washington, D.C., as Jim said, that, like, you know, President Trump can tweet something on a Sunday night and they've got to have a response and a plan of attack ready by Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
If he says that we're going to put a tariff on Mexico for 25% of all goods, you know, escalating to 25% on all goods, well, then, shoot, like, that's where a lot of beer is coming from. You know, we've got a lot of Mexican beer being sold in the United States. It's being imported here. Like, that throws the industry into a frenzy.
It's chaos.
And it throws stock markets. You know, we have publicly traded companies that are being impacted by these statements that he's making.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Beer Institute really has to be sharp and, you know, communicate with its members ahead of time, you know, so if this happens, what's our response? If X happens, if Y happens, how do we want to react?
Not only do they got to communicate with their members, but they've got to hit up the allies that they've built in these powerful committees, Senate Ways and Means, I believe Finance, those type of things. They've got to immediately get with those allies and be like, help us out here.
Right. And there's a lot of new faces in Congress, too. So, you know, establishing those relationships and, you know, building new allies is, you know, something that they had to do this year or that they're still doing.
And from the look of the CBMTRA numbers in the House, the number of supporters, they're doing that.
Right. They're an effective lobbying group for the industry. They play a pretty key role in, you know, what does happen or what doesn't happen. If you want excise tax relief, well, you know, the Brewers Association is definitely playing its role, but the Beer Institute is playing a role as well. For years, there's been a lot more of a defensive approach. We just don't want to see taxes get raised, you know, and so they kind of do it all. And a lot of people don't think about the Beer Institute when they think about, you know, who's protecting the interests of the, you know, thousands of companies that, you know, rely on this industry.
Yeah. And there are companies that see that, the smaller companies that we know of, like Cape May or Summit or Rogue or any number of craft breweries who have linked up with the BI over the years, Bell's, list goes on.
Yeah, sure, we're missing a few.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's they're an important group.
It's not just the top five.
Yeah, you know, and I just not to compare too much the differences between the BA and the BI here, but I feel like the BA does a really good job, especially Bart Watson, with sharing data and providing a lot of insights. And that's not necessarily, although they do have a chief economist in Michael Yerk, that's not necessarily the Beer Institute's like sort of primary function. It's a piece of what they do. So if you want the insights and you want all this amazing data and a little bit of of an understanding of a path forward. You know, BA is great for that.
NBWA too.
Yeah.
Can't forget Leicester.
Yeah. And CBC, well, that's a wholesale trigger. I'm thinking just for brewers, right?
Yeah.
You know, you go to CBC, you do all the learning. BI is much more agnostic in that way. Mm-hmm. They're like, hey, listen, we're not trying to tell you how to run your business. We have some general insights on just, hey, how much beer is being shipped. And we're able to process some of that, and we can give you a kind of a macro level of what's mm-hmm. going on. But our job is to make sure that the industry is protected and to work with all the lawmakers here in Washington, D.C. to protect your interests. So I think more small brewers should care about the BI.
Absolutely.
Especially when you're dealing with steel and aluminum tariffs and so many things that are impacting every single company in the space. So I'll stop the commercial for the BI now.
Yeah, you all have Jim's number after that, so give him a call.
Yeah. Also, Trump is the most successful user of Twitter, huh?
That's what Jim said.
I mean, he's got like over 60 million followers, I think like 61, although he's complaining now about losing followers.
But if you think about how he uses the platform, it's not that far off.
Oh, by blocking people and...
Well, not by blocking, but it's exactly what we talked
having
about.
Having a court of appeals tell him that he can't do that, it's against the First Amendment.
Hey, I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about what we were saying earlier was... You know, day by day, this thing changes. He's throwing things out there literally in real time that nobody else has heard of until, like, they see it in 240 characters.
I mean, he really has kind of changed the way that everybody operates in Washington, D.C. And I hate to say it, but Jim makes a good point. Congress moves very slow, and President Trump wants to move things very quickly. Mm-hmm. There's a time and a place where you need to... You know, slow down, be a little bit more patient, and let the process be the process. But I got to hand it to him. Like, even if all he accomplishes in his 4 or 8 years, whatever it ends up being as president, is picking up the pace at which things move in DC, that's good with me. I'm fine with that because things move so, so slow in DC. It feels like nothing ever gets done.
Yeah. Well, look at CBMTRA and how long that took to get done.
Right. So is he going about it the right way? Absolutely not. But is it somewhat effective if he's making things move a little bit faster? Then arguably maybe.
No comments on Trump. Well, nobody wants to hear my thoughts on Trump.
Listen, I think it's made everybody get a little bit sharper. That was sort of my big takeaway is like you could kind of hear it in Jim's voice where he's like, look, this is the reality now and we're forced to deal with it. So,
oh, yeah, you got to be on your toes.
We have to work a little bit harder and we have to be ready for anything. So if nothing else, he's forced Washington to do that.
He's forced a lot of people to set up Twitter alerts.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Well, thank you, Jim, for taking the time, as always, to sit down with us and to share your thoughts. Let's do our one segment of the week before we get out of here. We're going to continue the theme, the four pack theme. This is our third four pack now. You got that paper ready?
My little paper, yeah.
For the listeners out there who can't, because this is some bad radio, but Justin and I, we have notes in a shared document, but we keep our picks separate so we can't like snipe from one another.
Yep.
All right, I'm first. By the way, this is a four pack of summer activities that you can do with a beer. And this was born out of all the wonderful activity-based experiences that millennials have at bars, like axe throwing and petanque or petanque or whatever the hell that other thing was. I looked it up, by the way. It's like croquet, I think.
And this just fits our theme of beer. It's for every occasion.
It is for every occasion. So let's name some occasions to drink some beer. I go first this week. In starting off my four-pack, I think the all-time summer activity that requires a beer and more than one beer, multiple beers, is going to a baseball game.
Ooh, that's a good one.
A summer baseball game. Now, we're spoiled here because we have Fenway in Boston, iconic, amazing, you know, historical park, right? But is there anything better than going to a baseball game? It's hot out, your sun's beating down on you, and you're cooling off with an ice cold beer at a game?
I think there is.
Oh, yeah? So, well, that's my first pick. So what's your first pick?
It's drinking a beer on a boat.
You know what? You can't steal that one.
Oh, actually, I can, and we talked about this earlier today.
All right.
So I told you I was going to take your second one.
How did you know that was going to be my second one?
What because if I took, that's what? Absolutely what you're going to be doing here in like 7 days.
Okay, so you didn't know that that wasn't going to be my second one.
Oh.
See, you got it wrong. Drinking a beer on a boat, like you can't, like what? The boat has to be out in the middle of the ocean. You have to be doing something on a boat.
Sunning.
You're sunning on a boat? Are we?
I'm probably not. Have you seen me? I'm translucent.
Do you have a slip in the harbor?
Yeah.
Are you actually using this boat? Are the engines running? Are you sailing? What kind of boat are we on?
We're just chilling, man.
What kind of boat are
we on?
Chilling
on a boat.
Okay.
Godzilla.
You're on the Godzilla. Okay. Drinking a beer on a boat is a great summertime activity. I will hand it to you. Now, I mean, you can look at the list when we're done here. My second one was actually going to be fishing. So while I will be on a boat drinking a beer on a boat, my second one is actually fishing, because the best day of fishing, even if you don't catch a fish, you still catch a buzz. So I think if you're fishing, you have to have a beverage in hand, and it's, you know, the beverage of moderation, beer.
It is. Yeah. And while I'm moderating my consumption, I'll be at a concert drinking a beer.
Ooh, that's a good one. Outdoor venue or indoor?
Outdoor venue.
Yeah, you gotta specify outdoor there, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel like all these activities are outdoor, right?
Okay, so that's the baseline. Outdoor concert, where are you going? I mean, are we talking about like an amphitheater? Are we talking about concert in the park?
Yeah, we're talking an amphitheater, band you've heard of. Something like that.
I like that. The Rolling Stones played at Gillette this past week.
Which neither of us could afford to go to.
Okay, my third one is going to be playing cornhole. We mentioned it, a week or two ago. Throwing things on 4th of July. You have to throw a baseball. I think cornhole is definitively the best lawn game or bar game that you can play with a beer in your hand.
It absolutely is, because that was on my list.
Oh, well, looks like I got one from you.
I guess I'll be on the sidelines at the barbecue, though, drinking a beer.
If you're grilling and chilling, you got to have a beer.
Mm-hmm.
What are we grilling up, and what's in our hand? Are we drinking a double IPA? Are we drinking an ice cold lager?
I think we've got some imports. Definitely some imports.
Okay, so let's recap. Your three are
boat,
drinking on a boat, drinking a beer at a concert, and drinking while you're barbecuing.
Yeah.
My three are drinking at a baseball game, drinking while you're fishing, and drinking while you're playing cornhole. So for my fourth and final pick, I'll go with an all-time summer classic, which is filling up that cooler and lugging it to the beach, oiling yourself up.
Ugh.
Getting that nice cook.
We do not need these
that
visuals.
That nice freshly baked cookie tan.
We do not need these visuals.
Cracking open a nice cold beer on the beach. That's number four.
Damn it.
So you don't have a fourth?
No, I do.
Okay.
You did take that was going to be my fourth one, but I am actually going to go with beer garden.
I had that on my list as well.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that these are all great places, great opportunities to drink beer. I love the beer garden thing. I had also on my list honorable mention kayaking or paddleboarding. Paddleboarding's a little bit more difficult, but I don't know if this falls into the boat category. I don't think it really does, even though it floats. How about this? Just floating and drinking a beer on a river or a body of water.
Yeah, I had floating in a pool.
Yeah.
One of those giant inflatable unicorns or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
Looking ridiculous.
I mean, you got to get the humongous, like, rubber ducky or unicorn, like you said.
Yeah.
Put it on a giant lake and just see where you end up. You make a lot of friends that way.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else did we miss? Maybe drinking a beer while you're driving home. Oh, no. I'm kidding.
That's a Heineken 00.
That's a Heineken 00.
Yeah.
We can do that now.
Brooklyn Special Effects. An athletic brewing.
Yeah, well, you can drink a non-alcoholic beer while you do all those activities. Oh, that's a good one. How about running a summer 5K or 10K and rewarding yourself with a nice beer at the end of the race?
That's not too bad.
I think that's a good one. How about hiking? Go up to the mountains, you summit a nice big peak, crack open a beer. It might be a little warm at that point, but yeah, you're still drinking a beer at the top of a mountain.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
I think that's a good one. Any others? What else did we miss?
I can't off the top of my head. I'd say dog park, but, you know, you're not supposed to publicly consume.
Hey, maybe go to Vegas and do a pool party. That's a good spot to drink a beer.
That is not a bad place.
You got DJ Tiesto or Steve Aoki.
Rob Gronkowski doing cannonballs.
Yeah, Rob Gronkowski is doing push-ups and handstand push-ups. And
spraying everybody with a super soaker. Beers.
Yeah. I mean, these are all great opportunities. So beer industry, get on it. Highlight all of these, especially the last one of Rob Gronkowski.
Maybe the NBWA annual convention will get that wild. Maybe we'll have that nice Vegas warm weather.
Well, you know,
in October.
A couple of other opportunities for drinking beer at the tail end of summer might be the California Craft Brewers Association Summit out in Long Beach, California in September.
I heard that Brewbound's going to be on the road.
I think we will be there, and you will learn more about that in the weeks to come. In the meantime, I got a boat to catch, so
let's get out of here.
Let's do this thing. That is our show for this week. Thanks for tuning in wherever you're listening. We are available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, Libsyn, and SoundCloud. If you like what we're doing, please leave us a rating and a review and share the podcast with your friends. Drop us a line over on podcast@brewbound.com if you'd like to be featured or if you just want to share your thoughts. Thank you to our audio team, our guest, Jim McGreevy, and to all of our big, beautiful listeners out there in beer world. Catch us next week for episode 46. Until then, cheers.
Bon voyage.